Today, in a special episode on Just World Podcasts, an interview with veteran anti-war activist and organizer Frank Joyce. Hi, I'm Helena Cobbin, the president of Just World Educational. This podcast episode is an inter-season special, an interview I conducted recently with Frank Joyce, a veteran anti-war and workers' rights organizer who was the co-editor, along with Dr. Corinne Aguilar San Juan, of the 2015 anthology The People Make the Peace, Lessons from the Vietnam Anti-War Movement. The People Make the Peace presented reflections on their Vietnam-era activism from 9 notable anti-war activists who in 2013 traveled back to Vietnam as a group to see at first hand the bustling, self-confident country it became once the United States war efforts there had been defeated. In July this year, Frank Joyce and 4 others of those activists went back to Hanoi again, this time to celebrate the launching of the Vietnamese edition of The People Make the Peace. You can read more about their latest visit to Vietnam at the blog on Just World Ed's website, which is www.justworldeducational.org. Look for the August 2nd blog post titled U.S. Peace Activists Retrace Steps to Vietnam. In reflecting on this latest visit to Vietnam, Joyce argued that in the years after the anti-war activists of the 1960s and 1970s had succeeded in persuading the U.S. government to end the war, many of them started to experience an inferiority complex that led them to radically underestimate the value of what they had achieved. When I set up this interview with him, I wanted to explore that proposition with him, and also to get his insight on some of the challenging issues that have been facing the U.S. anti-war movement in recent years. We had a fascinating conversation that ran about 40 minutes long. But before you listen to it, I want to put in one final plug for the super distinctive book that lies at the heart of this whole story, which was published by Just World Books back in 2015. The People Make the Peace, co-edited by Frank Joyce and Corinne Aguilar San Juan, is available wherever fine books are sold. Be sure to get your copy soon. So now, here's my conversation with Frank Joyce, which was conducted over a slightly imperfect phone line.
I was really intrigued by the observation you made that the peace movement here that had been, you know, so widespread, so creative, so let us say successful during the U.S.-Vietnam War, subsequently people in the movement suffered something of an inferiority complex. So I'd just love for you to expand on that a little bit.
One of my assumptions is that there is very little realization in the United States of just how warlike and aggressive the United has always been as a nation. And that's not an accident. It's how we are taught in both religious and secular education, so that we're kind of disconnected from the history, for example, of, well, just how, what amount of violence was required for the United States to go from 13 colonies that were close to the Atlantic Ocean, even to the Pacific Ocean, never mind on to Hawaii and on to the Philippines and ultimately on to Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and so on and so forth. And because that history is sanitized, I guess might be one word for it, people don't understand how extraordinary it was that there was mass opposition to the Vietnam War in the first place. With all the wars the United States has had in its history, Vietnam is the only one which produced anything close to either the breadth or the depth of opposition that the Vietnam War did. And partly because even the people who were in that movement kind of didn't know that history and still don't know that history. There was never a sense of how extraordinary an accomplishment it was to have an anti-war movement that was as big and became as effective as it did. So that's the first issue that comes into play right off the bat. The second issue is that, of course, after the war, because the Vietnamese succeeded in defending their country, despite every effort that the United States could make to prevent that, then the revisionist machinery, particularly of the Pentagon, sort of kicked into gear to diminish the significance of what the anti-war movement had been in the first place. And that has been a nonstop campaign ever since. It used to have a name. Nobody uses this term anymore, but it was called the Vietnam Syndrome. And it was how we as a nation were supposed to, in a weird sense, heal from Vietnam and get over the fact that and these terms are problematic, I think, but get over the fact that the United States, with all its might and all its muscle and all its weaponry and all its financial advantages, lost the war to this tiny little country of uncivilized people. And in that adjustment, the post-war, where the post-1975 to the present, the propaganda efforts ranging from literally the Pentagon itself to documentaries like Ken Burns' relatively recent series on PBS, et cetera, has been about the manipulation of opinion about many things, but including about the anti-war movement. And it's a combination of neglect and fragmentation and distortion, as all successful propaganda efforts are. But my argument is, sadly, it's been very effective. So the conclusion from that is that the more we can revisit and help people understand just how powerful that movement was, the more likely it is that we can build another one. And really, in a way, that's the premise of our book, That People Make the Peace. I think we say at the end of the introduction something to the effect, the reason we wrote this book is because we want people to understand that if we did this once, we can do it again.
Right. So if you go back to the immediate post-US-Vietnam War period, one of the big changes, of course, was the ending of the draft and the introduction of the all-volunteer military. So presumably that had an effect on the prospect of movement building, because so long as you had the draft, you had, you know, the sons of the political elite were potentially, unless they had, you know, something like bone spurs or whatever, you know, they were subject to being drafted. But once it became a purely economic draft rather than a whole age cohort draft, then the sons of the elite were no longer, you know, subject to it.
Yeah, I actually don't agree with hardly any of that. And I did, and we address it somewhat in The People Make the Peace, and I've subsequently written one article in particular that zeroes in on that point. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to that in this conversation. And my starting point is, first and foremost, the most important thing, if anybody hears this and only takes one thing away from it, I hope it's this. We do not have a volunteer army. We have a recruited army. And in this piece I wrote, I did a lot of research on the Defense Department budget. I believe it was for the year 2017. But there is a massive portion of the defense budget that is devoted to recruiting. And a massive portion of the defense budget has to be devoted to recruiting, because if we really had an all-volunteer army, all that would be required would be, you know, you could sign up on the internet and you could join the military, and that would be the end of it. But it's only the beginning of it, and one of the most conspicuous examples of the all-recruited army is the partnership between the Pentagon and professional sports in the United States.
Right.
When people watch a football game and see, you know, a flyover or see color guards and soldiers and so on as part of the halftime show, U.S. taxpayers are paying money to the National Football League to make that happen. And there are lots of other examples of the same thing. And so why this is so important, I think, is twofold. First, it's just to break this mythology that people are breaking down the doors of military recruiting offices to get in. No, they aren't. They're not doing that at all. There is more widespread support for peace than we are led to believe. This comes back to this whole inferiority complex idea. The value of the significance of the draft in the anti-American war, known as the Vietnam War movement, was not that it created opposition to the war. It was that it created a very effective form of resisting the war machinery. And we could recreate that same effect tomorrow if we devoted as much resources to disrupting the recruitment program of the military as we devoted to disrupting the draft. And I cite two, many points, actually, and then one of these is included. If we ever do a second edition of the book, I would hope that we would expand this section. But this notion that the draft tail wagged the anti-war dog is rebutted by two, I think, by many things, but two that are immediately important. One of them can be summed up in one word, and that word is Korea. If all it took to create a mass anti-war movement was a draft in which large numbers of U.S. soldiers were being injured and maimed and killed in support of an alleged anti-communist agenda, there would have been a giant movement against the war in Korea, because the two wars are virtually identical in their stated purpose, in the composition of the military, in the extent of the casualties being U.S. casualties, and in the extent of the brutality of the casualties being visited upon the Koreans, the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, and the Laotians. So that tail doesn't wag that dog. The anti-draft movement was created by opposition to the war. And the opposition to the war not only created a lot of creativity in resisting the draft, it created enormous creativity in resisting the war from within the military. And David Courtwright and others have written books, and eloquent and important books, about the resistance both to the draft and the resistance within the military. The other variable that gets overlooked in this notion that we can't war movement unless there's a draft is that much of the opposition to the war, and for that matter, much of the opposition to the draft during the anti-war movement in the 1960s and 70s was led by women. Women weren't drafted. They couldn't be drafted. That wasn't an option at the time. But some of the most prominent names in the anti-war movement, from Cora Weiss to Joan Baez to Judy Gumbo to Alice Hertz to any number of others, were leaders of that opposition. And I could go on and on about guess.
No, those are two very powerful arguments. I want to just circle back to the lead up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
Okay.
I know there were anti-war movements in the interim. There was a big anti-nuclear movement in the early 80s, and there was quite a lot of opposition to the various U.S. wars in Central America in the 1990s. But the big sort of next appearance of an anti-war movement or emergence onto the scene came in 2002 in the build-up to the invasion of Iraq. And that one I was a part of, which, of course, I hadn't been back in the 1960s and 1970s. And, you know, one thing that a lot of my, older friends and people who'd been in the United States longer than I had, and I was living in Charlottesville, Virginia, and there seemed to be a general feeling that if you take one lesson from the Vietnam War, it's that you don't want to accuse the actual soldiers themselves of being baby killers. So there was this, like, widespread story that anti-war protesters in the 1960s and 1970s had treated the returning soldiers very badly indeed, and we didn't want to do that. You know, we wanted to support the troops but bring them home. That was like, you know, the mantra then. How accurate was it that there was a lot of harassment of returning soldiers, people coming back from Vietnam?
It was extremely inaccurate, but it was a part of the propaganda campaign that was very deliberately mounted after the war to paint the anti-war movement, you know, in a certain light and characterize it in a certain way. Now, that was true during the war as well. It's just that after the war was over, the environment in which that campaign was taking place changed quite dramatically in a variety of ways. There is a book, I can remember, we can fill this in later, but it has a title like something about nobody spit on anybody. That's not exactly the title either, but it's this notion, you know, that returning soldiers were spat upon. There's no documented instance of that ever happening, ever, not one. But it is a widely held belief, and again, it didn't become a widely held belief by accident.
Right.
Something that would help a listener understand this would be to think back to the Swift Boat campaign that was launched against John Kerry, which was itself a textbook example of effective propaganda, that John Kerry, of all people, could be redefined in the public mind relative to what his service in Vietnam actually was, is worth studying, and worth studying in the context of, well, how did some of these myths about the anti-war movement become so powerful that even people who had participated in the anti-war movement came to believe them, and believe them to this day? And one of them is about this notion that the soldiers were mistreated. The demand was always bring the troops home. One of the arguments within the anti-war movement, and one of the arguments particularly in the larger international context of the anti-war movement, was that the bring the troops home slogan was itself sort of nationalistic.
Right.
That it focused entirely on what was happening to U.S. troops as opposed to what U.S. troops were doing to the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, and the Laotians. And, you know, that's a conversation that is important, as important now as it was then as well.
Right. It's not all about Americans.
Exactly. Exactly.
So looking back at that era of the Vietnam War, too, I've seen a little bit of propaganda, and I actually remember being in England in, let's say, the late 1960s. I was fairly young at the time. And I looked at like some old copies of Reader's Digest, and there were, you know, all kinds of scare stories about the Viet Cong and the Viet Minh, you know, were raping women and cutting off their breasts. And like,
sure.
That just sort of a little memory of reading some of that stuff stuck in my mind. But was there a big sort of, let's say, you know, formulating the big lie?
Oh, absolutely. But remember that this process, this 500 years of colonialism and white supremacy and white nationalism, is cumulative. And as I've said earlier, it's systemic and it adapts and it readjusts. So here's something I think particularly germane to the special relationship between England and the United States. Very few people in the United States know that the Declaration of Independence is not just the preamble. The Declaration of Independence has the preamble, which is what mm-hmm. everybody is taught, but it goes on to list 27 grievances against the King of England that are the basis for seeking independence. Number 27 on that list, the grand finale, if you will, mm-hmm. is that the king is criticized for making alliances with savages. That's the term. The word is savages. And that, of course, is a reference to indigenous nations and indigenous people. And indeed, there were alliances between the British and certain Indian nations. And there were alliances between the British and African Americans that were underway at the same time, and there were also in formation. And I make that point to make the point that this notion of the white man is civilized and anyone who is not white is barbaric and savage is a very essential core component of the doctrine of white supremacy from the very beginning. And so, of course, you can look at any war that the United States has been in. And also, by the way, just to be clear, this is the nature of war, right? Everyone tries to otherize and demonize
and dehumanize
the
yeah.
opposition. But when you introduce color into the equation in the way it got introduced from the very origins of colonialism, then it would be surprising if that kind of propaganda were not an essential component of waging the war in the first place. Of course it is.
So one thing that interests me, well, many things that interest me about what has happened in the current century, but we had this very large, very like passionate anti-war movement nationwide and worldwide in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq.
Right.
And my experience of it was that the moment the invasion took place, it was like somebody let the air out of the balloon of the anti-war movement. Like,
uh-huh.
nobody knew what to do. And then there was like, you know, well, we can't undermine our troops while they are overseas. And like, the movement just seemed to collapse almost overnight.
Well, I think you are essentially right about that. And I think it, in a direct or maybe a roundabout way, I'm not sure which, supports the point I'm trying to make here of how effective had been the cultivation of the inferiority complex of the anti-war movement by the pro-war movement in the period between Vietnam and the invasion of Iraq, and this overcoming of what I've referred to as the Vietnam syndrome. So, for example, what might have been a different outcome to the invasion of Iraq had the anti-war movement had this notion, and some people did, by the way, and you know their point was not effective, and that has to be understood and looked at. But some people did try to interfere with the recruiting machinery that was in place, and that is particularly directed at young people, at high school students, rural and urban. And so, in a way, we didn't come up with the tactics and the strategies that had been effective in Vietnam. There's another key variable here, and that is the disintegration of the vision and the connections of international solidarity and the anti-colonial struggle, of which the war on Vietnam was a part, in a way that the war on Iraq was not perceived. And there's an oversimple, but I think effective way to clarify that distinction. And that is, Osama bin Laden was no Ho Chi Minh. No one could identify with the righteousness of the struggle of Osama bin Laden as the personification of 9/11 in the way that people could identify, for historical and other reasons, with the anti-colonial aspirations of the Vietnamese. And so that's sort of two variables that help, I think, us better understand the very important question that you're raising about why haven't we been able to be more effective in the post 9/11 period. And it's hard to think of like a more important question than that we should be wrestling with, and to the point where we need more of these kinds of discussions and conversations and looking back at, okay, so what did happen? And just to pile on a little bit here, in my opinion, one of the key places to start that conversation is reexamining what was the opposition movement to the war on Vietnam all about in the first place.
Yeah, that is a really important point. Now, coming back to the kind of Iraq invasion period, so obviously there was Osama bin Laden, and then there was Iraq, which was separate. I mean, you know,
well,
in spite
Saddam
of
Saddam Hussein was no Ho Chi Minh either.
Right. And then you had active American participation in the regime change project in Libya and Syria,
right,
and in the Saudi war in Yemen, and then more recently, not actual military help, but a lot of political and economic sanctions help to the regime change project in Venezuela.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
me,
I would add one more point to that list, Alina. As you well know, a part of this assessment needs to look at the arc and the trajectory of the shifting issues around Israel and Palestine, because that too has to be put, I think, within the framework of how propagandists deliberately framed certain questions and impacted public opinion and redefined the imperial project in a way.
Right. I mean, one of my saddest memories, I have to tell you, is because I had worked as a journalist in Beirut for 6 years at the beginning of the civil war there. And I had married a Lebanese person, now my ex-husband, but, you know, he's somebody I've obviously kept in touch with, and we have 2 children, 4 grandchildren. And I came out of Lebanon because of the children in 1981, and then in 1982, the Israelis launched a massive invasion, ground invasion of Beirut, of Lebanon,
uh-huh,
right up to Beirut. And, you know, all my friends were stuck in Beirut and being bombed the hell out of. And one of the people who went to support the Israeli armed forces ringing Beirut at the time was Jane Fonda. So that boggled my mind.
But it goes to this point of the very, you got to give credit where credit is due, the very smart latching on to the perceived moral authority that Israel had at that time and in that context, which sort of made Israel, strange as this sounds to even say in a way, but made Israel the successor to Vietnam. And your story is perfect. What would better symbolize, who would better symbolize that than Jane Fonda?
Well, exactly. I mean, it still like makes me reel every time I think about it. I mean, I was sitting here in Boston, Massachusetts. I was writing a book about the PLO, and I could not like go out in the morning because I was like crying so much about what was happening. And then you get on the TV and you see Jane Fonda going rah 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 with the Israeli troops. It was very, very weird.
Well, it is very weird, and that, you know, the Jane Fonda is still, for lack of a better term, unprocessed information in analyzing all of the very questions that we are talking about, and she is still, and I experience this routinely, including every time I talk about the book, The People Make the Peace, someone brings up Jane Fonda and the accusation that she was a traitor to the United States and so on and so forth. I mean, this is virtually as raw a wound in 2019 as it was in 1973.
Interesting. You know, the same gets said now about Tulsi Gabbard for having gone to...
Good point.
And, I mean, I don't agree with everything Tulsi Gabbard does, but I have a lot of respect for the woman, and I think her reaching out to President Bashar al-Assad is one of the good things about her, you know, but she gets vilified for it.
Well, I agree with that, but this brings us back to the question of the vilification. Because where does the vilification comes from? Well, in the macro sense, the vilification comes from the 500-year history of colonialism and white supremacy and the more recent history of white nationalism. More specifically, it comes from a machine that has vast resources at its disposal to amp up the vilification, to introduce the vilification into the system, and then to increase its effectiveness. So this is no different than what we see with the response to The Squad, as it's called, right? I mean, we have seen this movie for 500 years. And what I think it's too easy to lose track of is the points where we have been able to make a different movie, and still are, right? I mean, we are still not without effect and not without impact, but I do come back to the original premise of part of our problem is to get past our own inferiority complex, that we didn't achieve anything then, and so how could we expect to achieve anything now? Well, we achieved a lot then, and we're already achieving a lot now. Let's build on that.
Yeah. No, I think those are excellent points. Regarding places like Libya and Syria, one of the things I've noticed, I'm particularly concerned with Syria because it's a country I know very well, and I've written two books about it. And, I know all kinds of things that the government there, you know, abuses that they have carried out over the years. But one of the things that's really disturbed me a lot is to see so many people in the so-called progressive or liberal or human rights or humanitarian movement in this country jump onto the bandwagon of regime change in Syria. Which, you know, and they had done that with Libya before, and they didn't do it regarding Iraq. I mean, we all knew during the movement, you know, to try to prevent the war on Iraq, that nobody was trying to prevent that war because we love Saddam Hussein. I mean, we were all clear about that. But we were trying to prevent that war because preventing the war was the right thing to do. But now, many of my previous, like, colleagues and compañeros in the anti-war movement against the war in Iraq are cheering on the regime change project in Syria, although not as much now. Right. You know, now it's not, it's kind of...
It's not so fashionable, but yes, I understand your point. Well, again, I think part of this circles back to this, the value of understanding the opposition to the war on Vietnam, again, because it helps to understand what I call regression to the mean. And regression to the mean in the United States, and this is true in all the colonial powers, it's most powerful, of course, in the United States, but you know, it helps understand Brexit and Great Britain and so on and so forth, that this notion that we have come to terms with the loss of empire is no different than having come to terms with Roe v. Wade. No, we haven't. It's just a different phase in a very long-running battle. But the U.S. population, from the very beginning, is used to getting its way with other regimes. You know, there's a joke in Mexico, I don't know if you've heard this or not, I learned this from Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. There's a joke in Mexico which says, yes, we will build a wall and we will pay for it, but only if the wall is built along the lines that were drawn in the Treaty of Guadalajara.
That would be good, yeah.
But I make that joke to make the point that people in the United States don't know any of this. Well, more and more people, I think, in the United States are paying attention to this history and are trying to come to terms with what is the actual history of the United States. But the point is that why shouldn't we conquer? Why shouldn't we decide who the regime of Syria should be, just like we decided who the regime of Hawaii should be, just like we decided who the regime of Mexico should be, just like we decided who the regime of California should be, just like we decide who the regime of Venezuela should be, or of Nicaragua, or of Cuba, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
This is the norm. This is the expectation that people have and that people are taught. When you go to Sunday school and when you go to elementary school and even before and when you turn on the TV, this is the message you get 100% of the time, almost. Well, from some sources, it is the message 100% of the time. Fortunately, there are some other sources. But
So Frank, now we have obviously front and center the prospect of a possible military attack against Iran.
Right.
And, I mean, I think this is, you know, a moment when we need to really figure out what can the anti-war movement do at all levels.
Agreed.
So what kind of wisdom can you share?
Well, this is, maybe we should, you know, hit a point of demarcation here or something and have this as a different discussion, but maybe not. I mean, a couple of things that come immediately to mind is, and one of the things that I do try to do here, and particularly in community of Paso Robles, California, where I spend a good part of time. There are several local peace organizations here in many of the surrounding communities. And one of the things that is clear to me here and elsewhere is how fragmented is the peace movement. It's one thing to say that a mass movement is a big, hot mess, which certainly the opposition to the war on Vietnam was a big, hot mess, right? That's the nature of a big movement. It's got all sorts of internal conflicts and contradictions and disputes and so on and so forth, but it's big. And what we're looking at now are a gazillion little small peace organizations. So one thing I think to think about is how to overcome that obstacle. How do we get more organizational and street strategic cooperation between the various peace forces that do exist all around the country? I mean, there are millions and millions of peace-loving people in the United States and in Britain and in France and, you know, not to mention Syria, Lebanon, Vietnam, et cetera. So kind of reframing how that tissue gets better connected than it is, I think it's a question. I'm not saying that I can say right now or, you know, even with more time, exactly what the answer is. But I think that we can define that as a project. And as I've been saying, I think a part of that has to do with reinterpreting our own past. You know, we like to talk about we need to come to terms with our own past. Well, I think the anti-war movement needs to come to terms with its own past. And on the side of looking more, I mean, we got people all around us telling us what we did wrong. We need more people looking at what we did right. And it was a lot.
Yeah, and I think you make a great contribution to, you know, acknowledging that history in your book, People Make the Peace. So I'm, you know, really proud to have been able to publish it. And, you know, maybe we can go on and do more projects, although I'm not publishing any new books right now. But this conversation is great, and I'll bring it to a formal close and say thank you very much, Frank, for talking to the listeners. But let's get back together and talk about these issues more soon.
Great. Thank you very much.